complaint.
Grievance and victimhood are
a kind of grievance culture, an age of grievance.
The Trump grievance fest.
It's just this grievance tour.
The airing of grievances has really come to define America today.
Today on Vox Talks Economics, does the grievance doctrine make sense of Trump? Welcome to Vox Talks Economics from the Center for Economic Policy Research. My name's Tim Phillips. Every week we bring you the best new research in economics. So remember, follow us, then you won't ever miss an episode. Also, tell your friends and your colleagues about us as well, because I've got a feeling that this is an episode they're not going to want to miss either. Now, what if trade policy wasn't really about trade at all? What if it was about revenge, power and punishment, tariffs as tantrums, diplomacy as drama? You won't find something called the grievance doctrine in economics textbooks, but there's one book that explains what it is, what its policies are, and the way it is currently being implemented. Richard Baldwin of IMD Business School Lausanne, founder and editor-in-chief of VoxEU, of course, is the author of that book. It is called The Great Trade Hack, and it is free to download from CPR. And in it, he sets out the way what he has termed the grievance doctrine has been weaponized by this US administration, how the rest of the world could respond, and what might happen next. Richard, welcome back to Vox Talks Economics.
Pleasure to be here and talking with you, Tim. Thank you.
Congratulations on getting the book out. Everything's happening so fast at the moment. Was it a race to get the final full stop and hit send before everything changed?
Yes. The Chinese deal had to be put in as a prologue because that changed a number of things. But what I had been working on these LinkedIn columns, 5 to 10 pages, for almost a year. And Trump had been talking more or less the same stuff. So I'd been analyzing them. And I took about 15 of them and sewed them together using artificial intelligence to help me along. Would have taken me 3 or 4 months if I'd done it by hand, but I did it in 15 days.
Now, the grievance doctrine isn't the only thing in this book, but it's something that particularly sticks out as an idea. So can you define it for me? What's the narrative? Is the grievance doctrine something new?
It certainly is new for trade policy. I've been following this stuff for 40 years. Occasionally, governments will talk about unfair actions of foreigners, and sometimes they even get a little shirty about it. This is a systematic, mythic arc where the United States naively played by the rules, got played. The American middle class paid the price while globalist elite at home and abroad got rich off of them. That establishes a sense of victimhood that raises the entire trade policy into something like a moral imperative and a mission. And that mission is vengeance.
People in the rest of the world might be looking in on the American middle class and thinking, they've not got it so bad. The economy, well, at least until recently, was growing pretty well. They've got a pretty comfortable way of life. Not everyone, clearly, but on average. Do they have a legitimate grievance with the rest of the world?
Well, I think they have a legitimate grievance. So the middle class malaise is a reality. What is not true is that it's all the fault of foreigners. It really is a fault of American policy. So here's how it works. There was in the 90s, two shocks that hit every advanced economy in the world. And that was first ICT, which made replacements for people who work with their hands on tools, but turbocharged the productivity of people who work with their hands on keyboards. So that was a fundamental increase in inequality that was disruptive. Then that got turbocharged when the same ICT changed the nature of globalization to allow offshoring and outsourcing. And this confronted people in manufacturing, or more broadly, who worked in goods producing industries, with a threefold pincer. They were automated by robots at home. They were competing with China abroad. And they were displaced by offshoring. And those three things really disrupted a lot of communities. And the outcome was social pathologies we've never seen. 800,000 Americans have died of opium overdoses, which never happens at other places. Frequent school shootings. There's an obesity epidemic. The rates of marriage are falling. Suicides. Something's gone wrong. Now, my view was that this same globotic shock, globalization and robotics, hit all the advanced economies, but all the advanced economies except the United States had social policies that helped the middle class adjust.
Right.
Things like universal health care, you wouldn't get thrown out of your apartment if you'd lost your job and couldn't pay rent, and also lots of training to help people adjust. That didn't exist in the United States. In the United States, you were on your own. Traditional Democrats, traditional Republicans, they could not put in the policy because that would involve raising taxes and bigger government, which somehow or another is completely off the table in America.
What's the role of the global financial crisis in all of this?
The global financial crisis, 2008, and in particular the Great Recession afterwards, really fell very hard on the heads of the American middle class, and not just the ones in manufacturing. But at the same time, the people who caused this, all those bankers, none of them went to jail. The ones who were running the banks that set up these subprime loan pyramids that collapsed, they got bailed out. Nobody bailed out the workers. Chrysler, for example, the company got bailed out, but not the workers. So it was really a moment where it was like, okay, the system's rigged against us, and it seemed to be the same, whether it was Republicans or Democrats. And I think that's where the middle class really started getting this dialogue of victimhood, that they were a victim of the things. Now, the whole American political elite was seeing what was going on here.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than take the blame for lack of domestic policy that every other advanced country had, they turned the fingers outward. They pointed to globalization because globalization was the easiest thing to blame for all their problems. So Obama put on hold all the trade agreements that Bush Jr. had started. Obama 1, Obama 2, that was trade hesitancy. Then Trump 1 comes, trade hostility. Then Biden comes. Didn't undo any of the things that Trump did. It was a bipartisan by that point. And now Trump's turbocharged it. So I think that was really triggered by the global financial crisis.
It is remarkable that the World Trade Organization, a very consequential body, but something that really not a lot of people paid a lot of attention to, it has become the major antagonist in this story, the bad guy.
So the way the grievance doctrine looks at it is there are some villains of this thing.
Uh-huh, yeah.
And the villains are globalist elite at home who were profiting from this, why the middle class declined. And one of the ways they did it was by signing agreements and agreeing to rules that locked the hands of America so that they couldn't exploit the power of America. So Trump has actually on purpose broken all the rules of the WTO, and that's a sign of strength, not a matter of policy. It's like we have to disown what the traitors did.
My fellow Americans, this is Liberation Day. I'm waiting for a long time. April 2nd, 2025, will forever be remembered as the day.
In his speech, he said that U.S. had been raped, plundered, and pillaged.
For decades, our country has been looted, pillaged, raped, and plundered by nations near and far, both friend and foe alike.
By foreign globalists during this time. It's just incredible stuff.
50 years, but it is not going to happen anymore.
And the World Trade Organization as the tariff slayer. That whole policy agenda has been put into reverse in the US. This is what the story is all about at the moment. Let's put tariffs on everybody. Within this narrative, within the terms of this grievance narrative, what are tariffs for?
The grievance narrative says basically that the middle class was harmed and deindustrialized by foreigners. So there's the middle class harm, there's deindustrialization. And in particular, Trump and his surrounding has taken hold of bilateral deficits as a measure of the theft. When China sells more to the United States than the United States sells to China, that bilateral imbalance is exact dollar measure of how much China is stealing from America.
Right.
So the first thing is to correct the bilateral deficits. And this formula, most economists were slapping their head when they saw it and they go, what? Where did that come from? Nobody guessed that one.
No.
But it is mathematically linked to closing the bilateral deficit. And Trump, the whole came around it. The embodiment of everything that's wrong is his theft, and we have to end it. So that's the first thing. And it can't, absolutely.
No.
We can talk about that in a second. The second is that it's supposed to reindustrialize America by bringing back jobs, which were stolen by foreigners through cheating. It wasn't a change in comparative advantage or a decline in American competitiveness, it was stealing and theft. Close the deficit, help the middle class, reindustrialize America. Those were the goals. And by the way, tariffs are the perfect thing for that. That's why Trump thinks it's the most beautiful word in the dictionary. Can't imagine something better in his mind.
In his mind, but clearly these policies were not put in place to impress trade economists. You point out, and your colleagues point out, that doing this will, according to economic theory, make everybody poorer in the end. How is this presented to non-trade economists so they think, good idea?
Actually, it makes sense. Let me start with the trade deficits. The fact that it's impossible to close a deficit with a tariff is very, very counterintuitive. Because you and I buy vegetables and beer. And in that world, a tariff would change what you buy. So if foreign beer went up, then you'd tend to buy local beer, for example. And so the idea that you can shift people's behavior at a micro level is very clear to people. But that's only one half of it. The other half is the macroeconomic or economy-wide imbalance. The primary driver is that America spends more than it produces. Now, if it spends more than it produces, and those are economy-wide things that you and I don't think about, then those goods have to come from abroad.
Yeah.
There is no other option. So unless the tariffs reduce the spending, which they won't do unless it causes a recession, and even that's only temporary, or increase production, which they can't because it's a full employment economy already, it will not close the gap. So the tariffs will be offset by changes in the exchange rate. And so it cannot close the deficit. Now, that is so unintuitive that in the book, I call it the secret formula for the balance of payments. And I show statistically, actually, they're exactly the same, always have been, always will be, down to the last penny. But nobody will believe you. So there you go.
Now, we're talking about also bringing back industrial production to the US. And I still probably read arguments on X far more than I should do. This clearly resonates with American supporters of these Trump policies. Is it realistic that these will bring production back to the US?
Absolutely not. At the very best, tariffs can be part of a consistent long-term strategy. Let me say that I do think America needs a little more reindustrialization, needs an industrial policy. Just for example, America can't make the most sophisticated chips it needs and its most advanced weapons.
Sure.
Not only that, it's actually in the backyard of China where they make them. And Korea is the other place they make them. So U.S. cannot make any of its own 5G communication equipment, which is the backbone of its entire economy. They can't even make the naval vessels they need in the quantity they might need. So there was a neglect of the industrial base because of this end of history dream and market fundamentalism. They let stuff drift. That is probably stuff that needs to be reshored. And so Biden, for example, got a bipartisan consensus, spent billions of dollars, 5-10-year plans to do something about it. And maybe it would have worked. It was probably starting to work. But putting up tariffs is not really going to do it because you need long-term investment plans. You need coordination to bring the supply chain together. Above all, you need trained workers who don't just grow on trees. And in particular, this all has to be locked in for 10 years because you can't reshore manufacturing in a month or two. So the tariffs alone can't do it. And the fact that he keeps moving them up and down is not helping anything at all. So that's not going to do it. And also there's a distinction between final goods and intermediate goods, which he hasn't made. So there is something called import substitution industrialization. I don't think he's thought of that. But if many, many countries have tried to industrialize using import substitution industrialization, some work, some didn't. But you have to be very careful about what you put the tariffs on. So if you put the tariffs on the inputs, you're raising your costs and reducing the industrialization. If you put the tariffs on the final goods to block foreign competition, you may encourage local production. But he put the tariffs on everything when he took the 145% off of some of Chinese goods. It wasn't intermediate goods. It was consumer goods that were high profile. So it was done completely wrong.
One of the narratives we had a few years ago about this for securing supply chains was to talk about friend-shoring. In the policy that we have at the minute with this grievance narrative, the grievance seems to be more or less universal. It's hard to work out who your friends are.
Yeah, it's the craziest thing in the world to treat every single country with the same tariff formula, your deep allies or your real rivals. Like China is a real rival to the United States, and they all got painted with the same tariffs. There was lots of moves potentially for the U.S. to put together a coalition of countries who would say to China, look, you have to play fair with these subsidies. That China is generally playing by the rules. It's just the rules weren't set up for their kind of economy. So it would have required another discussion. A lot of countries have similar beefs with China because their manufacturing grew so quickly. And there would have been a way of potentially learning to live together and get the Chinese to be somewhat less interventionist in the subsidies, or at least put guardrails on that. But now that's all over. So now it's everybody's suspicious of the United States, and China has come out of this as a huge winner at a geostrategic or reputational level. Same with Russia, India, Saudi, Turkey, Brazil, lots and lots of countries now look much more like the grown-ups in the room when it used to be the US.
Imagine for a moment that some manufacturing did come back to the US, and imagine for a moment that the trade deficit was reduced. I'm seeing a disconnect here. Would that solve the middle-class malaise?
Not at all, for many reasons, but there's a very, very obvious one. Tariffs go on goods. They can protect American workers in goods-producing sectors. The problem is that there's less than 10% of American middle class who works in those sectors.
Right.
So for all the rest who work in service sectors, they're just simply raising the cost of living because they have to pay more for their goods. But there's no way that those tariffs will protect their own jobs. It is going to backfire on the middle class as a whole. There may be a few workers who are helped by this. We talked about the industrial policy that Biden was pursuing. One of the big problems they had when they were trying to reshore, for instance, semiconductors, was to find workers who could actually work in 21st century factories.
Mm-hmm.
There's plenty of smart people in America, but they don't necessarily want to work in a factory. The tariffs can't help the middle class. In fact, will probably hurt them.
Recently, we spoke to Moreno Bertoldi and Marco Buti about how the EU should counter US tariffs, whatever those tariffs are by the time you listen to this, and whether Europe can maintain a united front in a trade war. Listen to our episode, How Should the EU Respond to Trump?, published on the 18th of February.
Okay, so we talk quite a lot about US policy. You speak a lot to policymakers in other governments. The chaotic policy shifts seem to have caused quite a lot of confusion amongst these policymakers. Is that true? What are their options?
Mostly what they're saying, what happened? What's going on? They literally are lost. They grew up and their parents grew up in a world where the US was a steward of the system.
Yeah.
And if anything, they thought they were the victims. They thought the US rigged the system to help American business. And I think that's probably true. But all of a sudden, America's a victim. That's difficult. Also, this administration is not filled with extremely competent people. So trying to do 90 deals in 90 days when you only really have two or three people who both have the confidence of the president and some competency in these kinds of negotiations, they're not getting through it. So a lot of countries do not know what the U.S. wants. An example of Japan. So their first discussions with the U.S., you go and you have your first meet and greet and you exchange a list of, I'd like this and I'd like that. And then you see if there's a landing zone and then you start whittling down the list. And then when the Japanese ask the American says, no, what do you want to give us? And they would not articulate what America wanted. They just wanted a list of things that Japan would give them. That was very confusing because that's not the way trade policy does. Funny enough, it's like the Ming Dynasty's system of tributes. The foreigners would bring expensive gifts to the emperor for the right to trade with the empire. And the whole thing was not so much that the emperor needed all this money, but the tribute and the recognition. What the U.S. is now asking for is tributes, basically. Some countries have figured out that the tribute is cheaper if you give it directly to the decider in charge.
Mm-hmm. Like a large airplane, for example.
Not like a large airplane. Or starting a Trump Tower in your capital city.
Uh-huh.
But in general, they're looking for happy headlines.
Uh-huh.
But you can see, for example, with the UK agreement, that it just has to look good. And the US-China story, China didn't really agree to it until they saw how the Americans were going to spin it. And so the main thing for the Chinese was not to be humiliated. And the main thing for Trump would be to say, I did something no other American president had done, which is get something out of the Chinese. And without any fact-checking, that's the happy headlines he wanted, and they're off to the races. It's confusing because it's not at all like what trade negotiations normally are like.
Now, the grievance doctrine is, it's emotional, it's angry. Is there an argument that perhaps it might just be worth sitting this one out and waiting for it to go away after the Trump administration finishes?
I wish it was that easy. 4 years is a long time.
Yes.
This thing started 17, 18 years ago. It might get more polite and it might not be as chaotic in terms of what's going on. But there's no way that the U.S. politicians, either on the left or the right, can back off on this stuff. U.S. protectionism is on a loop. The middle class malaise, which is for real,
yep,
is being blamed on globalism. Not everything is tariffs like in Trump, but anti-globalism, or at least trade hesitancy, is now baked in. Both the Democrats and the Republicans have bought into various versions of this grievance doctrine. So under Biden, for example, he called it worker-centric trade policy, which was in fact anything except trade policy. They would talk about anything except trade. And that was just fine because it was worker-centric. So you could see they're buying into the narrative that globalization was hurting the workers, therefore we have to protect the workers. Nobody can oppose what Trump did without sounding unpatriotic. Mm-hmm. It would be probably suicidal for somebody to say, let's go back to even the liberalization of Clinton or Bush Sr. So it is not going to end, in my view. This is the beginning of the post-American leadership world, and the whole rest of the world has to get used to that because America is not going back to the way we remember it.
So if we accept that there is a post-American leadership world, we have to work out what that is. What does that mean for countries? Can they get on with deepening trade links amongst themselves and basically say, if the United States doesn't want to work with us, we just don't work with them? For example, could we strengthen the World Trade Organization again and go back to working within its rules, focusing more on that, and stop thinking so much about the United States?
I agree with some of the things you said, but not all of them. So let's leave the WTO one aside, because
yeah,
if nothing else, the U.S. is still a member. It's a consensus thing.
Well, yes, of
They're
course.
They're a dog in the manger there. They won't pay their bills, but they can still veto stuff. Now, it's not going to come through the WTO. But you're very right. The U.S. is directly involved in about 15% of world trade. So what the U.S. does is a tragedy mostly for America, and it's not a good thing overall.
No.
But if the other 85% of trade stays sensible and the grievance doctrine doesn't get going outside, it's possible because lots of countries have grievances. If they defend the rules-based system simply by following the rules, then we'll be okay.
Mm-hmm.
And it's worthwhile remembering that these rules are very flexible, so you can retaliate with these rules. Let's suppose Chinese goods are now deflected from the American market into the European market. Then Europe can put tariffs up against those with dumping duties. And those are WTO compliant. Moreover, there's a kind of a big pressure for countries to find replacement markets. So there's lots of free trade agreements being signed. The UK, India, for example. And people are much more eager now to sign trade agreements. And so there'll be liberalization. That liberalization can be done under WTO rules. The idea that you admit there are rules, you respect the rules, and you try and follow them, as long as everybody else does that, we'll be okay. I hope we're going that direction. And in the end, what we'll have is an America with high tariffs on its imports. It'll have high tariffs on its exports. And America will just become more closed. And that's sad for America. But the whole rest of the world can get on with it. The analogy I like is that for decades, China and India decided to not participate in the world economy.
Mm-hmm.
China was explicitly closed. India had all these crazy regulations, so they were really closed, and the whole world got along without them. Now, it was very nice that they joined, and everybody's richer and the world more prosperous, but the rest of the world could get along without them. And I think the same thing's true of the US.
Give us a scenario then. Give me two scenarios, an optimistic one and a pessimistic one, in either order. And also, I'd like to know which one you think's going to happen.
Okay, well, I'll give you the most pessimistic one, which is a return to the 1930s chaos.
Wow.
And I will remind you, the 1930s chaos was sparked by a similarly isolationist, emotional, irrational rise of American tariffs called the Smoot-Hawley tariffs.
Yeah.
What happened then was there was no rules to put guardrails on things, and then retaliation against retaliation and blocks formed, and it was a dark year, so it deepened the depression. It was terrible. If that's going to happen now, there's really two triggers. So the first one, and the novel one, is that the U.S. is insisting on people like the U.K. try and strip China out of their supply chain, forcing other countries to take anti-Chinese policies. Mm-hmm. And China has said that they would retaliate against that. So you could see you start to get American irresponsibility triggering other kinds of tariffs, and we can easily come into this tariff vigilantism world. And trade war is like everything. The first thing you lose is control. You pretend you have control, but since there's so many countries and so many products, eventually emotions get involved. It could spin out. The second is what we talked about before is trade deflection. So all the exports, manufactured export to the US that get blocked, those show up somewhere else. And those import surges lead to protectionist reactions in many countries. As long as people use WTO rules to put up those protections, which puts specific limits on them, it's a justification so you don't need necessarily to retaliate against them. It's all rules-based, a commercial dispute rather than a trade war. As long as that happens, we'll be okay. But you can see between those two, there's pretty significant pressures for raising tariffs among the other 85%. Some of the darkest moments of human history happened in the 30s. Fascist Germany had its own trade bloc. Imperial Japan had its own trade bloc. Commonwealth had its trade bloc, et cetera, et cetera. Now, that's the bad one. I do not think that's going to happen because I think the other 85%, they and their parents, the entire generation, all the professors they ever had, viewed the world trading system as the exoskeleton of global prosperity. And certainly the emerging markets, anybody who's under 60 has seen globalization be a wonderful thing for them. In the G7, it's been a lot of deindustrialization, but still not growing quite as fast and not growing as fast compared to the rest, but still doing pretty well. So I think they want to defend it and they don't really see a way of going away from it. So the optimistic scenario is muddling through. We see a little bit more protection, which is WTO compliant. We see a lot more trade liberalization among third countries looking for new markets, as long as it's WTO compliant. And we muddle through. I don't know if you remember the narrative we had before. There was the transatlantic trade investment partnership, and there was a Pacific one. It was TPP, TTIP, and these regional things were all merging together. And so like these blocks get bigger and bigger, and they eventually form the world trading system, which is pretty good. It's not necessarily as neat as centric, but it was going towards world liberalization with rules for the 21st century. Now that got blown out by, among other things, the global financial crisis. But that could go that way. So that's my optimistic scenario. And I think we're going to end up with a little more protection, a little more liberalization muddling through. And I do think that people will step up to leadership and replace the leadership in the world trading system with coalitions, not hegemons.
Well, let's hope that we relearn how to muddle through, because your dark vision of the consequences of the grievance doctrine is very dark indeed. So let's hope for optimism. And Richard, thank you very much for talking about it today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
You'll want to read the book now, so I better tell you how to get hold of it. The title is The Great Trade Hack: How Trump's Trade War Fails and the World Moves On. The author, of course, Richard Baldwin. If you go to cepr.org, you will see a link to download it. It is free to download. We'll put a link in the show notes.
Vox Talks Economics is a Talk Normal production. The assistant producer is Megan Bieber. And our editor is Andrei Zagarian. Next week on Vox Talks Economics, how we close the authority gap for female experts.